and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Volkelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 659.
That's right. It is time for something a little different, and probably something you expected from us all along, because of course we were going to talk about it, but we have been waiting to talk about it for a long time. And it is finally here. The next option for Green Lantern to be in live action. We have seen something now.
Yes, I guess we could. Interesting way of putting it, but yes, we have seen something. All of something. One eighth of something.
No, I mean, it's been 15 years and a lot of bad jokes and digging a hole in the mud for over and over by Ryan Reynolds. Thank you, asshole. But we finally have something where they're taking it seriously, it seems like. And we're here to talk about it. So this is... Where should we start with something this monumental?
That's a good question. We never did kind of figure out where we were. Well, let's talk about the time frame of this show, since it's a long it's a pretty long time frame. It's a big window, which makes it intriguing because of what the connective tissue is going to be through most of this. So we start in 1996. When Hal has apparently been Green Lantern for 10 years, but he's just basically come out of the Green Lantern closet. No offense to Alan Scott, but he's come out publicly as Green Lantern when before he was not. Nobody knew who he was. Thus probably explaining the Funko Pop when he was wearing his mask. So we'll probably get a flashback of that at some point in the series, I would assume. So he's been Green Lantern since 86. And this show takes place in 2016, the bulk of it so far. And thanks to that... hologram flashback, we know that that something pretty important must have happened between Hal between 2006 and 2016, because his personality is completely different. And then we end in 2026, where you get the ending, which, well, I guess I don't think we'll necessarily have to dive into it immediately, but we have the big shock ending at the end of episode one, which, you know, trying to explain the status quo, what it means to everybody, including Jon Stewart and I suppose Guy Gardner, based on that quote too, and all this stuff. So yeah, it seems like it's pretty interesting that it covers such a broad period of time, even though I guess on the bright side, if you're a Hal fan like you and I were talking about, the one thing no one can complain about is at least Hal was Green Lantern for a long time.
True. Also, interesting thing I noticed while you were saying that is that it's just got to be coincidental, right? That we're just doing this whole numbers thing in terms of like when we got
introduced to all the sixes.
Well, no, not just that, but like it's 10-year intervals. Whereas when we were going through the opening scene of Superman, it was like 3 centuries ago, 3 years ago, 3 weeks ago, 3 days, minutes ago. Like they kept doing the threes thing, and now we're doing these 10-year intervals. Like there's probably absolutely nothing to that, but I just thought that is odd.
I mean, it is odd. You're right. It may not mean anything because we're really focusing on one 10-year gap between 2016 and 2026. Though again, I mean, we know all the other, but it is correct that there's like, seems like every 10 years there's something significant that in 1986, Hal became Green Lantern and nobody knew who he was. And in 1996, he came out as Green Lantern and told everybody who he was. And then even through 2006, he seemed like a pretty easygoing, relatively mellow, happy guy, or jovial might be not be the right term, but he certainly was affable to a certain extent. And then we see the kind of the bitter, unhappy Hal in 2016, which is going to be the one where I'm almost assuredly we're going to be focusing in on the most, and that which does raise the question of what did happen between 2006 and 2016 that basically made him so old and bitter, which also I think factors into potentially why Hal hasn't made that backup of himself since 2006. I have to believe there's a specific reason why he's done that, not just because he's been slacking off. I'm kind of suspecting there may be a reason why Hal has consciously not done any more backing up and has kept that. Maybe that 2006 version is the last version of himself that's there.
I just think it's as simple as he doesn't trust the Guardians.
Maybe.
That's not uncharacteristic for Hal Jordan.
No, but now let's put it this way. If they were going to go down the road of some parallaxian thing with Hal, then it could make sense why he wouldn't back himself up, because that could have been the part of himself that still was shining through and consciously. Well, I don't either. Not just, well, I don't want the last member that the Green Lantern Corps has of me on back of being this bitter, broken down or this corrupted version, but also because that was still kind of like the best version of himself at that point. But I don't know if it's just that he doesn't trust the Guardians. I mean, because then why would it have been a full 10-year period? But we're gonna find that out, because it's almost guaranteed that whatever happened between 2006 and 2016, that probably is where some of the Sinestro stuff factors in, since that's probably when during that 10-year period seems to be when the Guardians probably became really disgruntled with Hal Jordan. They seemingly never wanted him to begin with, based on some of the background information we got here, which is not shocking. That's not overly original in a way that we know that no Green Lanterns were really supposed to come from Earth. And so, and maybe that's an opening way to go into it too, the fact that this show is being set up that we are definitely supposed to believe that Abensur crashing to Earth was not an accident. Him coming to Earth was not an accident. And that, because we know what's going on in Nebraska, which is where within 20 miles of where Hal actually got the ring, that, and even the fact that Hal put that, set that alert in his ring in case anything was going on in Rushville, that he would notify himself, which is kind of a weird thing to do. That's kind of a weird concept. But the fact that everything seems to be revolving around, give or take, the place where Abensur first crashed and where Hal first got his ring. That's kind of an interesting thing. That he's been the first Green Lantern of Earth, and Earth was not supposed to be a place where Abensur was supposed to be. That's for sure.
Yeah, if they're taking any inspiration from anything, maybe Secret Origin in terms of like Atrocitus's retconned involvement with Abensur and Hal Jordan and Sinestro and all of that. So I wonder if maybe like Aben was chasing Atrocitus and Atrocitus was heading there because he knew the Manhunters were there, or Aben was trying to beat Atrocitus to the Manhunters, or you know, something of that effect. Obviously, we'll figure it out. It's not, you know, what that actually ends up being, we have no way of knowing until we actually see it. But I think one of the interesting things to me about the show thus far is not necessarily what we already know is coming, like the Manhunters and what we presume is Atrocitus, but it's John's dad. Why he's raising his sons like this, what he's doing, why John still respects his father in 2016, at least, given what his father put him through, what his father knows about Hal, if anything, because they're both technically military men. So does John's father know of Hal? Does John's father, was the government training John or John's father or somebody in the military to take the ring from Hal at some point? Or is it just a personal ideals thing? He knows Hal, and he doesn't think Hal is right for the job, so he wants to prepare his sons to take on that, to be able to take on that. Like, obviously, there's a lot of speculation in what I'm saying, but like, what is behind what John's father is doing, both in raising his son? Is he doing that thing to both all of his sons? Is he doing it to just John? The other kids seem like this is not out of the ordinary, so. Was he, maybe he had no way of knowing the ring would pick one, you know, which one of the sons it would pick. So he's training them all that way. Maybe the Guardian ended up talking to his father. Like, there's again, like, I'm going off the deep end with possibilities, but, like, there's just so much there, especially given that that's an avenue of Green Lantern lore that I self-admit I don't remember much of specific about John's father. I remember lots of stories told about John's mother. I don't remember much about John's father. So what they could be drawing from, if anything, I wouldn't even bother speculating because I'd have to actually read it to know what the hell I'm talking about.
Well, we know John's father was abusive, so,
yes,
in the books. So this could be a reinterpretation of what abusive means. That maybe it's less physical abuse and more psychological abuse. There is certainly there is a strong possibility that the government being the government, that given a choice, of course, and the point is they really wouldn't have that much of a choice in theory, but they may not necessarily see it that way, that the fact that someone from Earth is going to have this power, luckily Hal's an American, but the point is that they would rather pick and choose the person that they would want. So maybe there was a concerted effort to try to see if John's father could raise his son to essentially be on the surface, the perfect candidate, and then maybe they could push the envelope and push things along a little bit. The succession plan.
Captain America situation where what was his name? Oh, I forget the name of the guy. They didn't call him Captain America. What was his pseudonym that everybody gave him?
Which one?
The guy that they tried to give the shield to instead of Falcon in the TV show. And then we saw
John Walker.
John Walker. What was his, what they called him? Something
US
else.
Agent.
U.S. agent. That's right. So like a U.S. agent sort of situation. Like if anybody's going to be this, it's going to be someone under our thumb.
Yeah, it could be something like that. But again, there's so much to do with the mystery of what's going on here and that's what it is, because it's tied to Abin Sur and Hal getting the ring, where he got the ring. And obviously Hal put in that alert for his ring to even notify him when something was going on and around that town. So there's got to be something related to Hal's origin to begin with, or certainly some other time between 1986 and 2016 in which Hal suspected something was going to happen in that place. And obviously he even talks about it to Jon Stewart in the show about that. The one thing they do a good job at establishing is that Hal's instincts are pretty good.
Yes.
Which is probably why Hal's been around as long as he has been, because of the fact that when he has a hunch, his hunches tend to pay off. So everything we've seen in episode one, what Hal thought he had a hunch or believed something was true, it turned out to be true. So that there's obviously something related to Hal's basic belief that it wasn't an accident that Abin Sur crashed there, that there was a reason that Abin Sur crashed there, whether Abin Sur was trying to get there on purpose and somebody crashed and did their best to make sure he died before he ever did what he was supposed to do there, which is more a likely scenario. As opposed to, Abin Sur was flying too close to Earth and somebody tried to take him out, and it kind of like became a self-fulfilling prophecy and ended up having him crash on Earth. I think it's probably more likely Abin Sur was coming to Earth and the Guardians didn't want him to come to Earth. And then or it could have been fate intervening where something happened to Abin Sur, but he was not. But clearly, Hal's perspective on this is that Earth really was there was no way Earth was supposed to have a Green Lantern. But the ring still operates on that level the way the ring is. Has historically been programmed to, it finds the next closest bearer that basically checks the boxes that you need. So that's why Hal got the ring when Abin Sur died.
Yeah, I like your point about Hal's instincts, because like, you know, they there's lots of humor in this, and there's lots of what like stoic judgment on John's face when Hal's doing his thing. But even John has to admit when Hal's right. Like he, especially when he goes down and tries to like, you know, let, you know, follow the rule of law and, you know, chain of command and so on and so forth, and alert the sheriff that, you know, this, you know, guy is a potential alien. She's like, yeah, I know. And you just tipped him off. He's like, I screwed up, didn't I? So like, you know, so like he knows. And like the whole scene where Hal is interrogating him and all of that, like he knows what's exactly happening. I love all of that. The other piece of what I love about Hal is it's interesting the ways in which he doesn't like John or seemingly doesn't like John. And it just feels to me, I read it more like he's not trying to get a rise out of John to piss him off. He's trying to see that John is capable of breaking the chain of command, of not following orders at all times, about following his instincts, about, you know, like so on and so forth. It just really feels like, and this can go back to the thing with John's father, like maybe Hal does know John's father and where John came from and is just trustful of him of that. Like, who knows? But like, regardless of all of that potentialness, like he just sees how straight-laced and the military jacket and so on and so forth that John Stewart has, and that the Guardians have picked him. And yeah, there's the resentment of, about the idea of being replaced and so on and so forth. But like, beyond that, every time you see him try to get a rise out of John, it really manifests itself in when he talks about sleeping with Macon's wife, because it's the first time Hal is like joking around and genuinely impressed, and like he like sees something in John when John admits that they've been there less than 24 hours and he's already slept with a woman. And it's like, well, I'm impressed with you. Like, and you felt like Hal meant that. Like, I think that I feel like Hal is searching for, if you're going to be my replacement, if you're going to do this, then I want this to go to somebody I can trust, even if he doesn't necessarily want to give it up to begin with. Like, he's like, okay, but if I got to be able to trust who gets the ring next, and somebody who's straight laced and following the rules and chain of command at all times and so on and so forth is not going to be able to survive long in this job, because there's 1,000 straight laced officers out there, but I've been doing this for, by the time he dies, what, 40 years? So
yeah, more or less it would be, I believe it would be, because and you could see, you could read into that too, the reason why Hal wants to make sure and even push John to think outside the box and not just go by these, you know, this is the checklist of things you're supposed to do in order in this circumstance, is because Hal himself is disgruntled with the Guardians, not necessarily just the Guardians are now distrustful, even though one can feed into the other. Is that Hal could have done what he needed to do, because obviously we, from the coming attractions, we know Hal technically, he broke some rule that he wasn't supposed to break, even though we stole the Green Lantern, but obviously he did something the Guardians think is a no-no while he was, you know, during his tenure as Green Lantern. So if he's kind of been treated, ostracized a certain bit over the last 10 years, and he's kind of been persona non grata, and he knows, it's as far as he's concerned, and he's probably correct, that he did the right thing and he did what needed to be done, but the Guardians still are treating him this way, that he could be seeing the other side of, kind of, again, not saying we're going down this road in real time at all, but it is very similar to how everything fell together in Emerald Twilight, when Hal kind of realized how fruitless and pointless it was being basically the Guardian's errand boy, when he did everything he thought, everything he was told to do, believing they had the greater good, and the one time that he kind of asked for something in return, that they kind of just flipped him the bird and said, hey, turn your ring over. That this could be the equivalent of that, that just the idea that he knows that the Guardians are not all that, but you kind of get a hint of at this too, when he's kind of thrown back in John's face, when John, almost like throwing in his face, well, the Guardians selected me. And it's like, well, the Guardians basically don't know shit. But the ring is what really knows whether you're Green Lantern material or you're ready to be Green Lantern material or not. So there's an element of that that could be going on too.
Yeah. And that was what I'm talking about was like, is also like it's canonical in a way that the friendship and relationship that Hal Jordan and John Stewart have, they made each other better in lots of ways. Like, I think in some respects, I think we've seen how he still flies by the seat of his pants all the time. Don't get me wrong, but there have been moments, I'm thinking particularly back to the time when John was leader of the Corps, where John would be like, you know, and forgive me, I can't pull a specific situation, but around that era where John would be like, no, Hal, here's the plan. I need you to listen to me. I need you to do this. And Hal saw that in John and went, okay, I'll follow the chain of command. You have something in mind. I trust you. I'll play ball. And then there have been times where John has learned from Hal and gone a little more off book and been able to fly by the seat of his pants. I argue those two have made each other better in those respects. And also, like a good canonical example, John taken too far with his ego and the chain of command and his ability to do it better has proven itself to be fatal, a la Odyssey, Cosmic Odyssey, when an entire planet dies because he believes he can solve the problem and won't let Martian Manhunter help. I'm really interested to see how the relationship between these two plays on screen as opposed to the way we've seen it play on panel over the years and how they have made each other better, especially since now they've got kind of 10 years and a few months, I guess, because how long have they said they've been training for? Like when he gets in the car is like 3 months or 4 months or something like that.
Two, I think.
Two. Okay. So like 10 years and some change that these two have known each other. Like how does from 2016 to 2026, how does their relationship change? And that's assuming that we don't see Hal again after that moment in the snow. You know, obviously we have to wait till the end of the season to figure out if that's really what they're doing or if they're going to stick with that or if they're going to tease something. We obviously don't know, but like they have 7 more episodes to build that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that's going to, if it was a regarding the ending, I mean, at this, maybe we should delve into that just because of where you're going with this, that because we obviously had talked about this several weeks ago, but when the leaks came out, I think most people honestly believe were pretty solid based on the way WB kind of handled things in an odd fashion. But the majority of this episode does take place in 2016. And once again, Hal's proven correct with the guy arrested at the football stadium for when all the bodies were for being the mass shooting that didn't seem really like a legit mass shooting, that this guy blows himself up because he's an alien and he's looking for vengeance, whether he's a manhunter or not. We don't know. Let's see if we find body parts or we find mechanical pieces or whatever they are next episode. But the very end of the episode cuts to 2026 in the same location where you obviously know something bad has happened over the years because I think you see the ranch and it's all pretty much gone to shit and all this stuff. But it ends up back at the same football field where Hal is waiting for John when he has to fly and drive to meet him in Nebraska after he leaves him high and dry. but you find what seems to be the body of Hal Jordan dead, bullet wound in the head. And his ring is gone, which, as I guess Tom King has said now, that Guy Gardner, I guess, has and is actively using Hal Jordan's ring, which does create a time frame for, which again, using the magic word, seemingly gives the impression that Hal might not have been Green Lantern, up until the moment he died. If you believe, depending on when Superman takes place, and I thought Superman was supposed to take place when it came out, not after, you know. That if Guy's already been Green Lantern for a while, then maybe Guy was already Green Lantern before Hal died. But nonetheless, either way, it seems to end with Hal Jordan's dead body being found in the snow on the bleachers. And we probably are going to, if it was a different creative team and if we didn't know kind of based on everything we've seen and read and the vibe of this show all along, if we didn't know that, then you could say, well, this could be a bait and switch where everybody's talking and treating Hal Jordan like he's dead, but he's not really dead. I'm going to unfortunately suspect that he is dead, but we should know. We should have more evidence to support that in the next few episodes, depending how much time is spent in 2026, because you would assume they'll be able to figure out from his body, from an autopsy, that he's going to be dead, that he's really Hal, that he's human or not.
Well, don't forget that line in the interrogation where they're talking about how many species can shapeshift, and he says 14, and he specifically refers to them as 14 species that no human means of detection would be able to identify.
Yeah, but we don't know if that's going to work when they're dead.
I'm only going off of what's said in the show. I'm with you. I think Hal's dead. Do I want him to be dead? No, but I think Hal is dead. All I'm saying is, the entire time as before the show even started, I'm saying I'm going to give it the entire season before I judge the season on the fact that they killed Hal in the first episode. I will let them tell me the story they want to tell me before I make my judgment call. I agree with you. I think he's dead, but I still have to like speculate on the possibilities.
Oh, we all know this possibility. Yeah. I mean, we talked about this like a few weeks ago. One of the setups that seemed to be dangerous about this show is that there's way too many potential shapeshifters between the Manhunters, between the Guardians with Atrocitus. It's like, so realistically speaking, you almost never know who anybody is. I mean, if it wasn't for the fact that the sheriff is still the sheriff at the end in the 2026 scene, she's about the only one you probably would say, okay, she's human. And even that doesn't mean she was human the entire time, even if she's human. I mean, I'm not even convinced that that porno there is Zoe. I'm not even convinced that she's human. I was awfully convenient of her meeting, hanging out, listening to John and Hal talk, her sleeping with John. That's awfully convenient, too.
That was definitely a setup.
Yeah, so there's almost like no one in this town that you would feel 100% confident about isn't necessarily an infiltrator or having been infiltrated and or mind controlled, even if they're not completely, even if they're not the magic dirty word like a Derlin. But I'm just saying that you would think, but you're that maybe that line about shapeshifters would also be applicable after they died. Historically with shapeshifters, that's really not the case, because it takes an element of control to hold a different form. But either way, I think at least as far as what the show wants, they're probably going to give us confirmation relatively soon. Now, there's a chance you can get a twist, because people who've seen the screeners of the show have only seen the first 7 episodes, which certainly implies there's got to be something relatively important, a big twist or something happening in the 8th episode that is not... You're not left on the cliffhanger like a comic book reveal in the final, like the final 5 seconds, episode 7, telling you what's coming in the next episode. It's like, oh, there he is. It's got to be something that the full scope hasn't really been revealed yet, because or else they probably would have let all 8 episodes go out in the screeners and not just 7. I think the overall first episode was really solid, as far as, I mean, it was Hal's episode. Hal comes across as he's not always likable, but he's always entertaining. And I think, generally speaking, he's more, especially since you see the different aspects of him, that he is true. I think he more or less is true to character. John, unfortunately, still comes across as boring. That is something that, as of now, still hasn't changed. But the mysteries raise and give a lot of potential. But of course, as we know, that one of the problems with mysteries is a mystery is only as good as the solution, oftentimes, and the resolution, the denouement. So if these mysteries and what they're teasing if it lands kind of flat as things play out, then maybe the original setup, we may feel different about how successful it works. But I think as a first episode, this was very, very solid. And they did a good job, I think, at hooking and reining people in, and maybe holding people who more or less might have been somewhat interested in the show, but were nervous about where it was going to go. I think they did a good job of walking that fine line, certainly in this episode.
How do you feel about the rest of it? Like, speaking of pacing, framing, tone, acting, score, like the actual Hollywood movie making or TV show making in this case of it all. How do you feel about the way everything looks and feels?
I think it's good. I think it comes across as relatively polished and high quality. I think I can't really complain about any of the acting in it. I mean, the interrogation scene was fantastic.
Yes.
On both sides. It wasn't just, Kyle Chandler was really good in this episode, because Kyle Chandler had the heavy lifting, because he was almost like playing 3 different versions of the character. I mean, he was playing, even though the 1996 version and I guess the 2006 version are very similar, but still not quite the same. And the 2016 version obviously is very, 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 very different. But that interrogation scene was just, you would expect Hal to go in there. And yes, she told him not to do it anyway, but it's Hal. But you would expect him, historically speaking, to go in there and kind of like bludgeon his way through everything. But he actually shows, he used his brain and his experience by obviously having dealt with shapeshifters before and infiltrators and things like that. And his point is valid, that they will be really good at knowing all the specific things based on to their undercover story that makes them believable in the role that they're trying to play. But they're kind of a blank slate, and they don't really know basic facts and basic things that almost everybody in an area or even as a society would know. And it makes no sense. So the fact that he's able to go on instinct, maybe he's bluffing a little bit at first, but then as he starts going down the road with these questions like about Obama and different things, it just becomes he becomes even more and more convinced that he's correct. And then either out of arrogance or just the fact that he real or because of the fact that he knows that he can't really get out of this situation anymore, that the jig is essentially up enough and he thinks he can take everybody out with the explosion anyway, when the veil is lifted and it's like, well, yeah, I mean, it's like, hypothetically speaking, it goes to this complete laundry list in a monotone, unemotional way of making it crystal clear. Yeah, everything he's saying is not hypothetical. It's absolutely real that he's an alien and he's got like a bomb built into a skeleton that can pretty much vaporize the entire town. He knows, he understandably knows about Green Lanterns. You would think he would have known. I mean, maybe he does know about Hal Jordan. He doesn't seem to necessarily indicate that he knows Hal Jordan personally or that he's heard of Hal Jordan before. But he knows, obviously, of the Green Lantern Corps. He knows the Oath. He knows about the ring limit. The time limit, which is another thing we'll have to get explained, because if they've been in town for over 24 hours, then maybe Hal does have a battery. Maybe they're going to go with that pocket dimension thing, that maybe he has the battery is available to him, and he either hasn't charged it yet, or he's about to charge it, or maybe the ring doesn't necessarily. Maybe the ring's going to work a little bit more like Kyle's ring, that it doesn't necessarily die at a certain time, but you do have a certain time frame that you have to charge it in, but it's not as rigid as the old rules. But it is interesting that the alien in question clearly knows the Green Lantern Corps and their MO.
Yeah, that interrogation scene, I like the duality of it specifically. Like, so you don't know, and if the shapeshifter is bluffing about the power of his explosive that he's laced with, but you also don't know if Hal's bluffing about whether or not he has the ability to handle that and whether or not he's charged his ring or whether, like, because the way he reacts, you're like, oh no, maybe he didn't, but like, is he bluffing the bluffer? Like, which is also a very Hal Jordan thing to do. so it was just cool because I liked seeing the games that Hal was playing with him in that, and that while he was screwing with him, he still had it under control and was perfectly fine letting everybody else think that it wasn't.
Yeah, I think that was a very nicely played scene, a very Hal Jordan like scene, and also like the scene in the bar where he was setting everything up for that fight because he wanted to get thrown in jail to have a shot to potentially do the interrogation that way. That was just the not so subtle setup for that. But on the surface, even John wasn't really picking up on it immediately what was going on. The fact that he fakes the $20 bill and he puts it in and he just loops the same song in the jukebox. And
he didn't get any change back. He only put in a 20 on a jukebox. So like. And he clearly intentionally selected this song for multiple times. He just wants to piss people off. Did you not think to just think about what he's doing there? I'd be worried about the counterfeiting if he got legitimate change back.
Yeah, that is true too. But I just think that's supposed to show the which is kind of funny when you think about it, based on the historical view of Hal Jordan. That Hal Jordan is always the one, despite his flying in where angels fear to tread, that Hal Jordan has historically always been accused of being too straight-laced, especially like by Guy. And yet, clearly, John in this dynamic is much more straight-laced and much more rigid and inflexible on the surface than Hal is.
And it might even be that Hal sees a younger version of himself, because clearly, and you already mentioned it, 2016 Hal is clearly something happened between then and 2006.
Yep.
So I think there's also, speaking to the acting, there is something else that bothered me. And I say bothered me, obviously we have the rest of the season to see it. The only performance I didn't like is it Josh Ritter? Is that his name?
Jason Ritter.
Jason, the lawyer. For Hal, obviously he didn't have a whole lot of screen time, so like there's not a whole lot to base him on. But I'm really only familiar with him from one role, which is on Parenthood. So obviously that's my only experience. He's a very straight-laced guy in that show, and all of that. And he seems to have this, you know, he's obviously the same person, so his voice sounds the same as Cadence and all of that stuff. But I didn't really feel like I got anything out of him. And I'm curious to see where that goes. Like, obviously, the whole Macon family is going to be pretty big in this whole, at least the 2016 side of this story, if not the rest. So I hope they flesh him out a little bit more. But I didn't really feel any sort of tie one way or another to that character. His father was menacing, and like, he even had some good points, but the way he played things, like how he seemingly knew that John slept with his wife and was kind of holding that on him and ribbing him about it, and his conversation with Hal, and like all of this stuff just had this air of menace about it. And we didn't spend a whole lot of time with him, so, but at least he made that impression. But Jason Ritter's character, not so much.
No, I can see that, because as soon as you started going down that road, I knew you were going to say that. I knew you were going to say that. So the fact that I knew you were going down that road probably indicates that it's not exactly coming out of left field that people might feel that way. But you're correct. We saw very little. We saw very little of him. We assume the father is going to be more of a main character. Plus, there is the other mystery, which almost assuredly plays into what's going on in the town regarding the aliens too, of who exactly his father is working for.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just a lot of stuff there, and that's why, again, I think that's part of why the episode works, is because there's so many mysteries. But once we start getting some of the answers, then almost law of average comes into play that not all the answers are going to be satisfying. And if too many of those unsatisfying answers, there's too many unsatisfying check marks in that answer column, then that could change the view on the show. Plus, we have to see the dynamic between John and Hal and see how that plays. In the first episode, despite the adversarial relationship, it worked. Like you said, you would like to get some acknowledgement from John, at least, even if it's, you know, grudgingly, the fact that, okay, I don't really think his methods, I don't agree with his methods, but they work. Or that I wouldn't be approaching this the way he has approached any of this. However, he's not exactly wrong, and he's kind of gotten us where we need to go, even if it was without any subtlety whatsoever. And just like you would like to see Hal acknowledge or see something in John himself about, you know, John's innate abilities. But yeah, I don't know. So overall, the first episode, I think, was pretty satisfying. I thought it was mostly well-paced. I know we were more of a captive audience than most people would be, but still, I wasn't bored by it. I thought it moved pretty well in the first episode, and the teasers of what's to come for the remaining seven episodes, I thought that was nicely done. There was enough stuff sprinkled in with of all the different things that we know, and if we, you know, for the people who've been paying attention that are coming in the show, and more of Laura Linney's guardian seemingly being a real shit disturber. So I really want to see if we find out who that guardian is, if it's somebody by name of significance, somebody that plays into the bigger mystery of what's going on here, even if it's not Blackest Night that they're setting up, which I think it could very well be Blackest Night that they're setting up.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to know, because she definitely seems to have an agenda. So that's what I want to see. I mean, everything she says seems to be rattling the cage, or trying to amp up Jon Stewart. But you can make a case Zoe is the same way. Maybe we'll find out Zoe is the same guardian.
Yeah.
Which would be weird, because he would have slept with her, though. So that would be kind of weird. But that's something that's probably not on Hal Jordan's resume. but the fact that, you know, she picked up on real quick that, you know, that he wasn't really patient. When he says that he's patient, obviously, and what they ended up doing kind of showed that he wasn't patient. But yeah, I'm very intrigued about Laura Linney's guardian character in particular, because I want to see if there's some context that's not nefarious necessarily, that becomes clear just by having seen more of their conversations fleshed out, as opposed to just having snippets of different conversations or snippets of the same conversation, just, you know, seeing from different angles, and in the way it's filmed, that it's all one conversation filmed in different, you know, with the cameras moving around and then being in different locations and wherever they're talking. I want to see if it, because that I think that's, I would not be surprised if that's significant who that guardian turns out to be.
Yeah. You were talking a bit about at the beginning of that about how, you know, Hal seeing the good in John and what he's capable of doing and John seeing the good of Hal. I think we've already got a little bit of that, like a little more so of Hal seeing John's capabilities and not necessarily so much John acknowledging Hal's. But he did in the interrogation room, you know, on the other side of the glass, say to the sheriff that he respects Hal. Now, he said it in the same tone that he kept telling Hal, yes, sir, no, sir, at the beginning of that. Yes. So, like, whether that was sincere or not remains to be seen. But if we take him at his word, he might actually see stuff in Hal. Plus, the little kid in him, the hero.
That's where I was. Yeah, that's where I would go. He might still respect him because he respected him when he was younger.
But John showing his abilities of you know, when they're in the stands and talking a bit about, like, you know, understanding what happened at the scene of the crime. Now, obviously, he doesn't understand the alien side of the equation, the lantern side of the equation. But just from, you know, what happened to get the emergency vehicles here and get this response, like the bodies on the field, the way everybody's positioned and logically what happened here, he's able to suss that out. He's able also, if I remember right, doesn't he identify the guy standing on the sidelines? Like, Hal's not the one who points him out to him. He just confirms that he was already suspicious of him, right? Because doesn't John? I think John points him out. He's like, so you know about that? And Hal's like, yeah, and does his thing. I could be wrong.
I thought Hal had.
Okay.
I could be wrong, but I thought Hal was the one.
Even if he did, at least that doesn't take away his acknowledgement of what he was able to suss out about what happened on the field. Also, the fact that he's able to chase the perp down, cut him off and punch him in the face. Like the fact that he reacts quickly when the car goes over the cliff and grabs the ring while it's floating in midair as he's and is able to call, you know, some bubble wrap to him or whatever. Like, Hal's obviously like, you know, a little like, what the hell, you know, about that. But hey, he did it. He's alive. Hal believed that he would be. I don't for a second believe Hal putting somebody in a literal case of where they will actually die because of an action he took intentionally without him having full faith John could get out of it.
No, so, like, I for the most part, I agree with that. I mean, again, we don't know what's going on with Hal, so there's always a chance.
That's true.
He's so disgruntled also about what's going on that it could be like a passive aggressiveness too. It's like, well, this really won't be a problem if the guardians are right that this guy's so good and he's going to be such a natural Green Lantern. Then instinct should take over and he should be fine. But I agree with you. I think essentially, if I had to bet, that he suspected that John would be fine. Now you can make the case, and that was. Now, you could make the case if that was 100% how we're supposed to interpret it, he would have actually put the ring in John's hand before he jumped out of the car. Because as we know, sitting on the dash, that thing could have bing, 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 ricochet rabbited anywhere, and John's story could have been screwed just for that reason. So that's something that we have to consider. But yeah,
unless Hal has some ability to exert control over the ring when he's not near it,
any Green Lantern does, which would make sense. You'd be able to call the ring to yourself. So it's like, but yeah, I think I agree with you. Generally speaking, I think in the first, there's a hint of some thawing between the two of them. But we'll have to see. Yeah, we'll have to see. We know there can't be too much thawing because we know they end up getting through a fist fight in the season.
That's true. So yeah, I think it's a good first outing. There are things to be concerned about. I made this comparison online earlier today. I'll make it here on air. I've said this. This may be your first episode of the show and of the podcast. And if so, welcome. But I've been saying this the entire time, even when the leaks came out, that Hal would probably die at the end of the first episode. I'm giving them the entire season to tell me the story they plan to tell me. I am taking a Schrodinger's cat approach to this whole situation. The thought experiment of Schrodinger's cat. I'm not going to explain it to you. Everybody at this point knows what it is. But the only definitive answer to the thought experiment of Schrodinger's cat is you have to open the box to observe it and get the answer. That's the only way you're going to get an answer to the question. That's what I'm taking to this show. I'm going to give it its season. I'm going to let them tell me the story they intend to tell me. And once that is completed, then I will make my choices about where I stand with all of this. I see where things can go horribly wrong. I see the good in this show. I'm willing to be entertained until they finish the story, and then I will make my final opinions. So don't take my positivity, and I'm speaking personally here. Mark can obviously talk to his personal opinions, but I'm personally speaking to my opinions here. Just because I'm being positive and finding the ways they can get out of ABC situations they write themselves into in this show doesn't mean I'm hoping for the best and it'll all be okay. It may very well not be, but until that such a time, I'm going to take the likely and least likely approaches, whether they're positive or negative, at face value and put them out there as possibilities, because we never know until we see it.
Yeah, I was thinking about this too, that the equivalent would be, we have seen, this would be the glass half empty approach, but it's kind of along this, but it goes along with what you said, that we've been down this road plenty of times over the last few years with different runs in the Green Lantern books, and which regardless of whether we were enthused or not enthused about what the new creative team was going to be or what the direction seemingly was going to be for the book, that more times than not, we've kind of liked the first issue of almost everybody's run.
Mm-hmm.
That we thought the first issue of the Thorn run was okay. We like Philip Kennedy Johnson's. We like more than the first issue of Jeremy's, but still. But the reality is we've seen many of these, if not almost all of these runs, at some point go off the rail, whether or not nearly as enjoyable, and that goodwill gets burned out really quickly. So, and there's also TV shows that we all know, there's shows that we've started watching that either the first season was great and then it goes downhill afterwards, or the first episode is like, okay, that's really intriguing, and then we're watching it and it just doesn't work, or it doesn't build or live up to the promise that we get in the first episode. So I think you said it perfectly that, yeah, there's a bunch of ways this thing could go wrong. There's a bunch of ways these things can go off the rails. A lot of it will be depend on exactly the story that you're trying to tell here and what the reveals are going to be. But it's just also, if it's 8 weeks of constant bickering between Hal and John, where they just can't seem to get on the same page at all, regardless of the fact that John can see that Hal knows what the hell he's doing, and he's been doing it for 30 years at this point, and that Hal can at least grudgingly see that, okay, John's got a lot of potential here. He's green, all pun intended, but with the right seasoning, and if I put my ego in check and teach him a little bit more and not be so afraid of everything I teach him he's going to use against me to push me out the door faster, that there's common ground. If we don't get a little bit more of that, then it could get real monotonous. And we'll have to see. And so there's a lot of goodwill. There's a lot of goodwill, but let's see where it goes.
Yeah. Before we move into the next segment, I did want to say there's been a lot of growth for our podcast over the past few weeks in the lead up to the show. I mentioned to you Sunday night before the airing of the episode, we crossed 2,000 followers over on Twitter, which is not a big deal for lots of people, but is a big deal for us. And we've already added another 50 to that. We've added several hundred over on Instagram. That video, one of those videos on Instagram, has currently over 20,000 views at this point. There are a lot of people just naturally finding us right now, and that reminds me of my first introduction to this show as a whole when Jim and Dan launched it not so long ago. Green Lantern was big at that time because of things like Rebirth and Sinestro Corps War, and people were finding the franchise and coming into it, and they were really invested in what they were seeing and reading, and they had questions. They didn't understand everything, so they found a place for those questions. I was one of those people, and my place was the Lantern Cast. There are a lot of people discovering Green Lantern right now because of this show, and I would be remiss if I didn't say, at least on the first episode where we're covering this, if anybody out there is new to Green Lantern, first of all, welcome. Happy to have you. Where have you been? We need more of you. But also, if anybody is new and has questions about how this franchise works, even if you think it's a stupid question, ask. write in, ask us, email us, ask us, leave us a voicemail, ask us, message us on social media, ask us. That was the Lantern Cast before I ever became involved personally, was my home for getting my questions about this mythology answered. I would love it if I could pay that forward, and we could be that for some people who are discovering Green Lantern in this new era.
A very good point. Very nicely put, Chad.
All right. What are we moving to next?
All right. Let's hold off on Green Lantern sales. I will edit this because we'll do that when we record Core.
Okay.
You might as well. So let's do something a little more interesting. So we both watched the Doomsday trailer, otherwise known as the special look, released at D23, which, by the way, D23 was a much more impressive performance and exposition as Comic-Con was, at least from a Disney. Like, that's exactly what you talked about, that they saved almost all their good stuff for D23, which is part of the reason
why I will re-express that is irritating. I understand why. I get it. It's their event, but irritating.
Yeah, it's part of the reason why Comic-Con is just not what it was. Not the only reason. I'm obviously COVID put a huge torpedo in the hull of Comic-Con. But yeah, they saved almost all the major announcements for, which we can talk about ever so briefly. But this was the trailer that played at Comic-Con, the Doom trailer, if you will. I still think this should have been the trailer they released first. This was a really good character piece for Dr. Doom, putting pieces into place about what his motivations are, showing what his power is. I'm really digging that accent of Robert Downey Jr. Mm-hmm. I think he nailed that. And of course, just like our common thread over the last few months, now you have the stupid internet theories, how everybody's now talking about how there's more than one Doom and Robert Downey Jr. really isn't playing the real Doom, you know, brought to you by the Captain Hydra people and the all this other stuff. Brought to you by the same people. I've been wanting to say this for weeks, so I'm going to say it quickly. Brought to you by the same people that even in 1999, after the movie came out, still argued that Palpatine was not Darth Sidious, even though Lucas literally shows you in that movie at the funeral scene that you're supposed to connect that Darth Sidious is Palpatine. By the way, he frames that after Mace Windu and Yoda's sidebar at Qui-Gon's funeral about who was destroyed, the Master or the Apprentice. And then the camera pans over to Palpatine and stops and focuses in on him. He was telling you by showing you. And in case you hadn't figured it out yet, that's your other Sith Lord. But people still insisted in 1999, oh, no, it can't be that. Sometimes people really want to be the smartest in the room and come out stupid. Now, Doomsday wasn't the biggest thing from D23, though that trailer was pretty cool. And the tickets are selling well, which, again, I would pump the brakes on that. I'll go into this more, I think, in our next episode. But just because at the moment they're outpacing Brand New Day's sales at the same point, which is kind of a weird comparison anyway, since Brand New Day's tickets only went on sale like a month and a half before the movie came out, period, versus Doomsday, which just came out like 5 months in advance if you count the stupid Infinity Vision launch of tickets several weeks ago before the ones they just came out of on Friday, since we're recording this on the 17th. That I would pump the brakes into thinking that automatically means, oh, it's going to beat Brand New Day's record when it comes out. There's reasons why, which I will go into probably next episode, why I don't think that's likely. Not impossible, but I don't think that's likely. We obviously had the announcement of all the new X-Men. Well, not all the new X-Men. We had announcement of some of the new X-Men. So did you have any thoughts on that? Most of those were what we thought. They did throw us a curveball, which obviously was done on purpose. The Indy Navarrete playing Rogue and not playing Mystique was obviously a bait and switch that they put out on purpose.
There are a lot of people online that are hating that casting. I say cool your jets. I think she's a great actress. I think she's gorgeous. Like, she's obviously well out of my age range, so I'm not trying to be pervy here, but like, she's a beautiful woman. I thought she did really good. I personally know her from Superman and Lois. I thought she did pretty well there. She seems like just I've seen her in lots of red carpets and interviews and stuff like that. She seems to have a good head on her shoulders, and I look forward. Like, I'm the Gambit fan. Everybody, longtime listeners know I'm the Gambit fan, so of course, by extension, I love Rogue. So I have a little bit of a soft spot for Rogue, and I want Rogue to be done a certain way. As long as they nail the accent and the personality, and she's capable of doing that, which I see no reason to indicate that she wouldn't be, I'm down. And I think that's great. Obviously, as with any casting decision, we still have to see it on the screen But until such time as we do, I see no reason to indicate that she won't do a great job.
And she looks more, and she's more built for the part physically than Kaylee Spaney was. Mm-hmm. I like when people, this is the funny part. People are complaining about the Navarrete's too short, but they didn't seem to care about complaining when everybody thought it was a foregone conclusion that Kaylee Spaney was going to be her, when one actress is 5 foot and the other one's 5 foot one. So it's just people bitching to bitch. And because, they thought everybody said this was true. It's just like, and the other bait and switch, which was good, was the fact that, I mean, we already knew that Adam Driver had been talking to them. But I guess the way Feige kind of spun it to make it sound like, oh yeah, we talked to Driver like every couple of years, and we pitched something to him and then he rejects it and then we move on. That obviously when they were talking about this like a month ago, whenever the rumors were first starting, and then it seemed to fade away, that they clearly came, they were already in agreement. Just like even the fact that they played games with the fact that, first he said he was Magneto, and, oh no, I'm not Magneto. Though he lost a lot of people because not everybody knew that the name that he was dropping really was, the alias of Mr. Sinister.
Yeah.
But still, that was an excellent, I'm happy for him because obviously he's been circling an MCU project for a while. It's probably a meatier part, even though you're not going to you're not going to be in as many movies in all likelihood as Reed Richards. But I think the way Reed Richards has been portrayed so far, that I think that was a smart move for him to pass on that role. I mean, I think it just seems like Reed Richards is destined for the time being to completely be overshadowed by Sue, based on the way they're writing it. So I think it probably was a smart move to not to take that role. Or at least not take it for the money they were offering him. I thought that was good. I thought that was really good casting. I was happy that Navarrete was playing Rogue because I thought she was because I'm also Mystique'd out. Mystique is just not that important a character. And she was used well in the original, in the Singerverse, because Rebecca Romijn's version was much better anyway. But she was used properly there. She's a side character. The idea of propping her up to a major X-Men character because you had Jennifer Lawrence play her, and, in the First Class verse, was a major mistake. I'm just hoping we don't have a Mystique at all in the first X-Men movie. And it did confirm what we had kind of suspected was very possible, that X-Men will be coming out in May of 2028. So that would be the first release post-Secret Wars. Smart move. Ghost Rider will be coming out in July. And then in December, I think it's December, that Black Panther will come out. So that is a very smart, much better planned out release schedule than how they launched Phase 4. So you give them credit for that. X-Men coming out with a home run hitter right off the bat, that's the smart way to go. I mean, that's not what derailed them afterwards, because Black Widow would have made shit ton of money without COVID. Not that that's the same caliber of movie, but it would have made a shit ton of money if there was no COVID. So that wasn't the problem. It's just the fact that they had a relatively weak slate with a lot of unknowns that were going to be coming out pretty early in Phase 4. And I think they got the right formula. It's like probably sprinkle in slam dunks and have sprinkle in the new stuff that you have to sell, sandwiched around solid, almost can't miss things. When you think about it, Ghost Rider has got the perfect runway, because if things go right for them, they're going to be riding into Ghost Rider like on a 4-movie winning streak, that they're going to ride in from Brand New Day to Doomsday to Secret Wars to X-Men. Now, yeah, on one level, it puts more pressure on Ghost Rider too. But if there is real momentum back in the MCU, where it does carry over from project to project, not just what it's been, where if you're interested in it, you'll see it. If you're not interested, you won't. Maybe that's going to be the permanent state of the MCU now, that it's never going to go beyond that again. It's always going to be project by project. But Ghost Rider will be a good test to see if there is a chance to carry a lot of momentum, assuming all those movies work and people like them. There'll be a lot. So I thought that was pretty cool. Speaking of, ever so briefly, since we're on talking about this subject, Brand New Day had a very nice hold, better than I think most people were expecting it to have in weekend three. So it barely dropped over 50%. It had like a 49% hold. So that movie is now about 788 million domestically, which, depending how busy today was Monday, and that might push it over the 800 million mark. If not, we know Tuesday will. So depending how it holds in weekend four, this has a very, very like, it's very like all but guaranteed it will pass Endgame, because Endgame, I think, is 858. I think Endgame is 858, because Brand New Day is 7. Like 85, or it's almost like reversing those numbers. So it's about $70 million away or so from Endgame. That should be, it should be able to do that almost no matter what, with a little, especially if it holds close to 50% again, one more weekend. And then if it does, then it puts you in a ballpark where the odds are it's going to get to the $900 million range, become only the second member of that club. And then the question becomes, does it have enough in the tank to possibly catch The Force Awakens? I don't think it will, but I think it has a really good chance of cracking 900, though, which would be pretty, impressive. But D23 was interesting. It sucked that it was so late because it was in California. It would have been better if this one was in Orlando because it would have started. It would have been more. But I was paying attention to that, and there was a lot of cool stuff that came out of D23. So I thought that was
your Lilo and Stitch.
Yes, Lilo and Stitch. That's cool. I'm trying to think what Incredibles 3, which I'm really not. I've never seen Incredibles 2. I saw the first one. I liked the first one. I never did see the second one, but the third one, like Coco 2, the live
Coco 2. I'm really curious. I get how, but isn't Coco just the perfect story, one and done?
Well, maybe because they aged him up. I didn't see Coco either, but that seems to be, I guess, the hook that they're trying to make this work with. But no, there were a lot of good projects. I'm glad they announced the as much of the X-Men cast as they could. Now, obviously, the guy who was going to play Beast dropped out, so they couldn't make that casting announcement. Does make you wonder how many more X-Men they're going to have in the first movie. It does make you kind of wonder. Because they're mixing matching to a certain extent. I mean, it's mostly original X-Men, with the exception of Rogue so far.
Yeah.
So that's which makes you wonder.
And Emma.
Yeah, but that's the thing too. It depends where Emma comes into play. Yeah. I'm thinking it's possible they may go with the original origin with Rogue, where Rogue's really not a good guy.
I didn't even think about that. You're right. She was working for Emma.
And she was with the brother, the sisterhood of evil mutants. She was working for Mystique. That's how I used. But you're right. But she was. Yes. People tend to remember that. Now I don't, because I was reading the X-Men and I had that issue when she first joined. I think that was another one of those. Welcome to the X-Men. So and so. Hope you survived the experience covers. That Rogue was, but I think she's being chased by Colossus and other people who, of course, logically don't trust her. That she could start out being, somebody who's not really, her heart's not really in it, but she's on the wrong side, and then she kind of flips and then joins the team. Not necessarily.
That would totally make sense too. If they're gonna plumb the depths of Marvel Comics continuity and give us freaking Sarah Gray in the Spider-Man movie, like. Yeah, they could start with Rogue's original origin.
And of course, which gets people going, because it's like, hey, if we want to get rid of Carol Danvers, here's our opportunity. but again, that's another reason why I was thinking, but they said they wouldn't be able to do the switch in one movie, because I'm pretty sure that happened before Rogue was. I'm pretty sure Rogue was still a bad guy when that happened. I could be wrong. I don't think she had completely joined the team yet. Because that was in an annual. That was in an annual when she sucked Carol Danvers' powers dry. But it is kind of funny. Now, it could happen accidentally, so she could still be a good guy. How Rogue was almost in the first X-Men, like when Rogue grabbed Wolverine and kind of was almost like draining him or whatever. And I think him. Wolverine stabbed her or something like that. It was something weird like that. It's been so long since I saw the first X-Men movie, but it was something like that. But it could, because she doesn't have full control of her power, so they could do something like that without it being blatantly obvious. I just thought about that. I'm looking forward to what they do there. It is cool that it doesn't seem like they're gonna go with the standard Magneto first, which isn't surprising because the Fantastic Four, for probably self-serving reasons, now that we know what's coming, that they didn't go with Doctor Doom first, which would have been the easy way to go. Not that Doctor Doom again was in the first comic book, because he wasn't, right? That was the Mole Man, I believe. Doctor Doom was early on, but the Mole Man was on the cover of Fantastic Four 1, just like Green Goblin wasn't anywhere near Spider-Man in Spider-Man 1 or Amazing Fantasy 15. but they're the villains you most associate with those heroes, so it's real easy to match them up with that. But yeah, good stuff. I think there's a lot of good stuff coming.
Before we wrap up here, I just wanted to add one quick thing. I wanted to extend a welcome to the club, to Juju Green, who is the host of the Lanterns official podcast on HBO Max. Because we obviously know everybody in the Green Lantern podcasting game for the most part. We got Will over at Green Lanterns Podcast. We got Ralph over at Lanterns Live, Dan over at Mosaic Comics on YouTube, and we got obviously Myron and Phil, podcast of Oa, and Donnie and Adam over at Multiverse Musings Lanterns podcast over there. It's been a long night, guys. I've had a long day at work. But Juju is now joining the ranks of Green Lantern podcaster. So technically, welcome to the club.
Indeed, that'll be a cool post game show to watch going forward. Probably the only reason I missed that Tom King thing was because I fell asleep on it last night. I did put it on and I did watch it. And for some reason, thanks to the great algorithm on HBO Max, and they started playing the White Lotus podcast. That's what I woke up to. Talk about, that makes a lot of sense. Hey, it's a podcast. That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works. It's like, and it wasn't even a video podcast. I think they just had something on the screen and they were talking, which would be okay. And it's like, what the hell am I listening to? And I squint at the screen and it's like, this is like the White Lotus podcast. It's like, now don't get me wrong, I enjoyed the first season of White Lotus, but I never watched any of the other seasons because there's really not much continuity, or other than I think the Coolidge character. There's like nobody that seems to cross over from season to season. But that's just a weird thing. They could have chosen to play the Green Lantern movie. I think that's still on HBO Max right now. So why do they play that of all? Can't you figure out what's the most likely comment? Their algorithms need more algorithm work. Your focus sure. needs more focus.
Also, it's Emerald Echo. Sorry, Donnie and Adam. I kept wanting to say Emerald Enthusiast, but I know that's Donnie's specific tagline.
That's what's in my mind too, which is why I wanted to jump in, but I was going to do the same thing. It's like the Enthusiast only is really for Donnie, but yeah. Which is still better than nothing where we were. to be fair,
but welcome to the club, Juju. So in the meantime, if people want to reach out to us, especially if they're new fans and getting into Lanterns and have questions about this franchise, what do they do?
LanternCast@gmail.com. The website is LanternCast.com. You can follow us on Blue Sky, Twitter, like us on Facebook, #GLCast to track us down. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, wherever you listen to us. Please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail or a text, 708-LANTERN, and let us know what you think. We have our Discord. If you want our Discord information, let us know. We have our LanternCast vids. That's our YouTube channel.
And the podcast is there, too.
Yes, the podcast is now there too. And yeah, so good start to the series, and we won't be dedicating an episode for every episode of the show, but we wanted to do the first episode, and we obviously will be talking about it a lot more, including wrapping it up when it's all done.
For sure. Good night, everybody.
Good night.